Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. Today, we welcome Joyce Harper all the way from across the pond. Joyce is an author, academic, scientist, and educator. She is professor of reproductive science at University College London in the Institute for Women's Health, where she is head of the Reproductive Science and Society Group. She is a director of the Embryology and PGD Academy and founder of Global Women Connected. Joyce has worked in the fields of fertility, genetics, and reproductive science since 1987. She's written over 200 scientific papers and published three books, her latest titled Your Fertile Years, What You Need to Know to Make Informed Choices. She started her career as an embryologist and then moved into reproductive science and genetics. Now she's researching fertility education, femtech, and social aspects of infertility treatment, including donation and IVF add-ons. Joyce is a passionate educator at all levels, from the general public to the PhD student, and she regularly appears on TV, radio, and in the press. Joyce has had many senior roles in the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology. Joyce was a director of the British Fertility Society and International Society of Prenatal Diagnosis and founding member of the Preimplantation Genetic Diagnosis International Society. She is chair of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority Horizon Scanning Group and an advisor to the HFEA Science and Clinical Advances Advisory Committee. She was a member of the Nuffield Council for Bioethics Working Group on Genome Editing. Professor Harper, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to chat with us today. You have accomplished so much in the world of reproductive sciences. So what got you passionate about all of this?
Well, I actually fell into this field by accident back in 1987. I'd been doing a PhD on alcohol addiction, and it was a new field. So the fertility field was really quite new. So Louise Brown, the world's first IVF baby, was born in 1978. And then in 1987, I was finishing my PhD and literally just looking for jobs that would be of interest. And I saw a job for an embryologist, so it wasn't even 10 years since Louise Brown was born. Very new field, very few clinics worldwide. And I just thought, wow, this is amazing. This is so fascinating. And then my journey began. And I've absolutely loved it, from being a pure lab scientist back in the early days in the 80s, and now being involved much more with public engagement and talking to the public and educating the public on all the things that I've learned. I'm always passionate about transferring the information I've learned along my journey to everybody else, because it's such important information that I think everyone should know. So it's great now. I don't do anything in the lab for about the last 8 years, and I'm just spending my time dealing mainly with fertility education.
Wow, that's awesome. I know, it's funny, I've had several guests on, and even myself included, that we've just kind of fell into reproductive health. I have a master's in reproductive physiology, and I just, as an undergrad, took a class on reproductive physiology and was like really blown away with, I just loved it. And so now that's been my focus too. And now also education. So like I said, there's a lot of topics I would love to discuss with you, and we'll see where time allows. But first, let's talk about what we're both passionate about educating people. And anyone who quickly browses your Twitter, and I'll include your handle and your info at the end, they can see that education, especially fertility education, is a huge focus for you. So let's talk more about your research on education, because you specifically study education and fertility education, and explain to listeners what femtech is. That was in your bio, and it's very interesting and really revolutionary. So can you talk to us about that?
Yes. And lots of people ask what femtech is. So it's quite an unknown term, but I quite like it. So
I like it too.
Femtech is using digital technology to help women understand about their health. So, you know, I've got an Apple Watch. So that's sort of femtech, but obviously man could use an Apple Watch. But we're really talking about things here like period trackers, fertility trackers, those sorts of things. There are various hormone tests you can get done, and the use of digital technologies to specifically help women. And so I have done a lot of research on the femtech area. We started this where there is an app called Natural Cycles, which is actually marketed as a contraceptive app. So women can monitor their menstrual cycle, understand when they're ovulating. And when you're ovulating, that's the time that you can get pregnant. And so you monitor that using what we call a marker of ovulation. So in this case, it's checking your temperature every day. So when you ovulate, your temperature changes. So this, it's a very small change, but we can pick that up with the thermometer and with the app to help women along. So that the app is used as a contraception app. It's telling women when they ovulate, so they avoid this time. And the app learns about the woman's cycle. Every woman is very individual. So no two sizes fit all. We're all so different. So we've really got nothing in common with regards to, you know, our algorithm. But it will work out your own algorithm for you and what's working for you with your menstrual cycle. But I was fascinated by Natural Cycles because I realized many years ago that they had millions of data on menstrual cycles of women. And I was really interested in the characteristics of the menstrual cycle, because I was very aware that if you read any textbook or if you were taught this at school, you're taught that a woman has a 28-day cycle and she ovulates on day 14. And I thought, no, we need to look at this data. And they've got the data. They know when the woman had her period. They know when the woman ovulated because they checked it. And so we looked at the data. We looked at over 600,000 cycles where the woman had registered an ovulation. And we looked at the characteristics and which day they ovulated. And actually, we found out a lot about how different women's menstrual cycles are. It was only 13% of women that had a 28-day wow. cycle. And most, about 65%, varied around 28 days, but plus or minus a few days. But you also have women with very short cycles and very long cycles and very irregular cycles. So the day they ovulate really depends on their particular cycle. But then moving on, we've looked at period trackers as well. We've done a few studies on period trackers. We've published a few papers on this. But the most exciting is a survey we did this year to ask women, how do they feel about using a period tracker? And a little bit of the characteristics of how they used it. So when they started using it, how often they used it, what data did they really find useful from that? And then we asked them to tell us about their experience. So that was all great. So we've just submitted that paper. But so that's femtech. And there's much more I could say about that. But let's move on to fertility education. So I became even more passionate about this because I went through 7 years of fertility treatment. I had ideally wanted to have a child when I was around 30. And the studies we've been doing to ask men and women when they want children, that's still a very common age. My children are grown up now, but age 30 is still the most common age that people ideally would like to have a child. So I wasn't in the right relationship at age 30. There's a long story, which I do go through in my book, so I won't bore you with now. So it wasn't till I was 35 that I started trying to have children. And I, you know, I had problems. So I've been through all the tests. I've been through many cycles of fertility treatment. My twins were born after frozen embryo transfer, and my eldest son after a fresh IVF cycle. So I've sort of been through the whole story. Mm-hmm. And my passion to deliver fertility education is that I don't want women and men to have to go through this journey if they can avoid it. And we really think that with education, some infertility could be avoided. And I would love couples to avoid having to go to the IVF clinic. It's a very hard journey, and that feeling that you might never succeed. And obviously some people don't succeed is really heartbreaking. Yeah. But we're seeing an increase in infertility. We're seeing people having smaller families now because they've left it too late and they're having problems trying to have one or two or three children. And the age that women have their child is their first child is going up in every country. So in the UK, it's around age 30, but in some countries, it's near age 32 that they have their first child. And the most important information that we have to relay to people is that our biological clock is ticking. And from age 30, female fertility starts to really decline. And it's really significant around the age of 35. So after age 35, quite a lot of women will start to be infertile and have issues trying to get pregnant. And by the time we get to 40, most women will actually be infertile. So we live in a culture where, you know, we always say 40 is the new 30 and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm almost 60, so I keep saying 60 is the new 40, definitely. You know, our ovaries don't think like that. So right. As far as fertility goes, it's not kept up with this, you know, healthier living. So we have a problem where we don't want people to experience infertility. So we want to prevent it. So that's where we're working. And I should have done this in 1987. I actually started writing the book because I was aware as I was learning about fertility that my friends didn't understand their menstrual cycle. And now my friends are going through the menopause and they don't understand their menopause. And so I felt very passionately a few years ago that I have to write this book. I have to get this book out there to make sure that people can make an informed decision.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I do feel like, yeah, the only education, at least, you know, I was born in the 80s and I think it's improving. I mean, I'm hopeful. I have to remain hopeful that education around women and men's fertility, because a lot of times women get the flack for being infertile, and it's 50-50 here. But I think that our generation or younger generations are starting to talk about this more, and we do have the apps and the technologies available so that we can learn more and educate ourselves more. And so I appreciate that. You hit on a lot of topics that I'd like to briefly discuss. You know, one, egg freezing. It seems like these technologies since you started in this field have really taken off, right? Like, so it started with IVF with Louise Brown, and now we're offering like kind of the new latest and greatest, which we'll talk about, is egg freezing. And then also PGD, which we will get to, which I want to, because that's a topic we've never discussed on Venus Rising. And it's something I want to talk to. But briefly, let's go back and talk about kind of egg freezing and this new thing that people are being offered, especially young women. And you know, I've read some material about this, and to me, it just seems like it's kind of like allowing men and women to delay things, but in effect, it's causing increased infertility because your body is still aging. Those, you know, you can freeze things, but it doesn't seem like it's really fixing anything. It's just an expensive way or another marketing scheme in big fertility. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with what you said. I call egg freezing, it should be plan B, not plan A. So when I was 30 and I wanted children and my partner wasn't ready, if egg freezing had been around, I would definitely have done it. But that would not have been plan A. Plan A would have been I really wanted a child around the age of 29, 30. But not having a partner or not having a partner who's ready is a very common reason why women are freezing their eggs. So I think in those situations, it is a valid backup. It's not a guarantee. It's very expensive. It's a difficult procedure to go through. But I do worry about the whole commercialization where we're encouraging young girls. And I always say, you know, our graduation present to our young women should not be marching them off to the fertility clinic to freeze their eggs so that then they can go and do all the things on their list before they then think about having children. So with the fertility education, we're giving people, men, absolutely men, it takes two to make a baby. and so we're giving men and women the information so that they can at least make an informed choice. And I would never tell anybody, you must do this or you must do that. Mm-hmm. Everyone's individual. Everyone wants to do their own thing. But what we do here is people, after years of infertility, or especially women in their late 30s, and say, but no one ever told me this information. And the men, you know, why didn't anyone tell us this information? So that's what we want to be sure that people know, and then they make an informed choice. So I said I want to try and avoid people going to the fertility clinic. And if egg freezing becomes the norm for young women, then we're going to get lots more people in the fertility clinic. So it's sort of defeating my philosophy over the whole of fertility. So I really think plan B, not plan A.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also find that, you know, so egg freezing is kind of similar in some regards as far as like the technology and the procedure as like egg donating. Obviously, egg donation, you're giving an egg to someone else. Egg freezing, you're donating it to yourself. You're keeping it for later usage. And it's really alarming to me, you know, reproductive medicine, especially women's health and fertility is fairly new, but we're still really lagging behind in the research of what it does to women's bodies. Do you find that particularly frustrating at all? Like, you know, we're still, you know, advertising egg donation on college campuses, yet we're really not studying cancer risks or any other risks on fertility for these young women who are signing up to donate their eggs. Like, what's your thoughts on that?
We do have now over 40 years experience of women who have gone through fertility treatment. So there has been some research looking at their outcome and how they've been, and there doesn't seem to be increased risks. But going through fertility treatment and bombarding your body with really high levels of hormones that are very strong is difficult. But I haven't seen any suggestions so far that there should be any increased risk of cancer or any other adverse outcomes from going through a few cycles of fertility treatment.
But are you talking more for like women who are doing this on their own? I'm talking about women who have donated many times. Like, it doesn't, in the United States at least, there's no tracking system. Like, if a woman donates 3 or 4 times versus 10 times, she's not being tracked later in her life to see what kind of diseases she might develop. Or
yeah, I was just about to say that the number of women who for their own treatment have gone through more than maybe 3 or 4 cycles is very rare. It's a very hard procedure to go through, and so most people we've done a study to ask people who were childless but who had wanted a child, if they went through fertility treatment, why did they stop? And the number one reason that men and women said was emotional. They just could not go through that treatment again. I always thought it was going to be financial, but it was emotional. It's such a draining procedure. It's so traumatic. And those of us that have been through this, even if we've had a child, we still say the trauma of the treatment never goes away. So I have heard of in some countries where women seem to be doing donations in double figures, and it really needs to be tracked. So in the UK, you couldn't do that. It's all tracked and it's all kept, you know, very regulated. But there are other countries, not just the US, there are other countries where it is definitely possible for them to give eggs multiple times. Even someone from the UK could go to another country and do it and would be under a different system. So yes, we don't know that long-term effect. And I have been asked that, what do you feel about someone who's been through 10 or 15 donation cycles? And I think that they would need to be really careful. So I hope it's not the norm. I hope it's a rare occurrence, but it could be quite lucrative. So I could imagine some women doing that. But yeah, the long-term risk to their health is really unknown.
Yeah, yeah. And my heart breaks for anyone who has to go through that and the emotional turmoil that must play. I've read Miriam Zoll's book, and to me, that really helped like kind of personify it. And I have friends who struggle with it too. So, and I can't imagine too, as an egg donor now with like new technology, like 21 and 23andMe and Ancestry, where, you know, now they're going through like, oh, I might actually have like a genetically related offspring out there, but I digress. I want to shift to a topic that, like I said, we've never discussed on Venus Rising, which is PGD, short for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Other acronyms that I've heard with this is, PRS, polygenic risk score, and polygenic embryo selection, PES. Can you briefly tell our listeners what those stand for, what they mean, what is this technology?
Yeah, so let's start at the beginning. So I started working on PGD in 1992, and two of the books I've written have been on PGD. So PGD was originally developed to help couples who were at risk of transmitting a specific genetic disease to their child. So cystic fibrosis or beta thalassemia, there's a whole list of common genetic diseases that a couple may carry and be at risk of having in their children. So that's why PGT was developed, and I was involved in the world's first clinic, and I started there just after they'd started. So was really involved right at the beginning. And for many years, it was controversial. People still felt that we were playing God and we were, you know, narrowing the genetic pool because we were only picking people who were genetically more desirable. But we were really trying to prevent the birth of a child with a serious genetic disease. But then in the mid-90s, a couple of groups in the US decided to start using the same methods, the same technology, to do something called aneuploidy screening. So the reason why female fertility declines with age is that the quantity and the quality of our eggs decreases the further we get away from the menopause. So further we get away from puberty and towards the menopause. So this is why when we're teenagers, we can get pregnant very easily. and when we're 35, it's much harder. And we also have more miscarriages because of the quality of those eggs. So there's quantity and quality. And the quality is mainly because the chromosomes in the egg. So it's the only technical thing I'll say, but with the egg gives half the chromosomes from the mum, and we get chromosomes from the dad in the sperm, and they come together. So those two halves come together to make a whole person that will be their child. And the chromosomes in the egg become very muddled the further we move away from puberty. And so we know that a woman trying to get pregnant at 34, 35 or beyond, part of the reason she can't, or part of the reason she miscarries, is because of these chromosomes. So it's great theory that if we do this genetic test, we can look at the chromosomes in embryos from people going through IVF and put back ones that are normal rather than abnormal, especially in older women where there's more chance of them being abnormal. And to do PGD, what we do is we take out one or few of the cells from the embryo and we do a genetic test on that. So in the 90s, two labs in the States started offering this aneuploidy screening. So before we'd been doing this procedure for specific genetic diseases. And now they were suggesting that, well, maybe everyone going through IVF should have this procedure so that then we can check that we're only putting back embryos that are chromosomally normal. The trouble is, it's been highly controversial for many decades, and something that's been a real bane in my life, to be totally honest. I've said that many times. In IVF technology, there's a number of what we've called IVF add-ons. So they're treatments that are not essential for you to have a treatment cycle, but they've been added on because the clinics normally claim that they'll improve your chance of having a baby. So this, if we're looking at the chromosomes, would that would be the theory that you're going to reduce miscarriage and you're going to improve the chance of having a baby because you've looked at the chromosomes. So what we need to do to prove this is we need to do a study called a randomized controlled trial. And this is where half the women would have none of the treatment and the other half have the treatment. And then at the end of the months or years that you do this, you then see what are the live birth rates of these two groups of women. So if we're saying the aneuploidy screening is going to improve live birth rate, and this is what most clinics market it as, we've done many publications about how clinics are marketing this and what they're saying on their websites, and they're saying it's going to improve your chance of having a baby. So if they're saying that, these studies should have shown that. And there have been so many studies. In 2010, there were 11 large studies, large randomized controlled trials, and none of them showed it worked. Some of them showed it made it worse. They actually had a lower live birth rate than the control group. And in the last 11 years, again, there's been multiple studies, some very large ones. And again, they haven't shown an improvement. But I know in the US, this is really a routine procedure.
Yeah.
And we published a paper last year, where we looked at the US data. We've done two papers on the US data. And one of them, we looked at the clinics. There were three clinics that had done this aneuploidy screening on every single patient who had come through. So in the UK, we have the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, and they're the people that govern fertility treatment in the UK. And they have given a traffic light rating system to the common add-ons. So we would say if there are studies showing that this treatment is going to be of benefit, we'll give it a green. If it's ambiguous data and we're not sure either way, we'll give it amber. And if there's no evidence to show that this is going to improve your chance of having a baby, we give it red. And in the UK, this aneuploidy screening is red. So we've made it very clear that all the studies have shown that it doesn't improve live birth rate. But I know in the US, it's just common and it adds on a huge expense. But what's more worrying is that over the years, many embryos have not been transferred that could potentially have made some children. And I know there's a couple of cases in Australia that have gone to court now about patients saying they shouldn't have been offered this procedure. Yeah, so the people that speak for it would say, but you're checking to see if an embryo has the right chromosomes, which surely is a good thing. And they would say that if you look at the data in a different way, it shows that it does help. But, you know, there's certain ways you can look at data. Right. We've looked at the data many ways. So there's two camps. There's those that are big fans of this procedure, and there's those of us that are very skeptical. But yeah, we've rated it red in the UK. Now, you asked about polygenic scoring, etc. So this is a very new technology that's just started with, I think at the moment, only one main company that is in America. I think there are other companies that are going to come on board soon. And these are saying, right, what we could do is genetically test the embryos for diseases that they might get as a person. So heart disease, a predisposition, well, they're all predispositions. We don't guarantee them, even when we might have a genetic susceptibility, but we don't necessarily will get them. And our lifestyle could certainly have an influence on this. So this includes diabetes, heart disease, cancers, etc. So these are looking at what we call multifactorial characteristics and diseases that can be affected by the environment and normally by multiple genes. It's not a simple story. So this is very new. What worries us for the future is that we're going to see more people who are not infertile or who are not carrying a specific serious genetic disease come forward for these treatments because they've got the money and they want to be sure that their child's going to be as healthy as possible, which I'm sure every parent wants their child to be as healthy as possible. But I just worry again, we're going to see more and more people in that fertility clinic, and there's a group of us trying to avoid people getting in the fertility clinic. So I do think in the future, you know, I always say to my students, how will you have your children in 10 years' time? I think egg freezing will become even more popular. I think doing PGD for non-serious reasons is also going to become a lot more popular. I mean, in the US, there's hundreds of, I don't know how many cases, but many cases every year where people just use this because they want a child of a particular sex.
Or eye color, even. I'm learning that you can now choose your child's eye color.
Yeah, eye color. There's growing number of lists as we understand more about genetics. On the genetic side, we're still, even though we've sequenced the genetic code, we're still finding out about all these genes. And yes, there are companies offering eye color, height predisposition. The IQ is a tricky one, but it's on the table. You could do perfect pitch. Yeah, wow. Sex, etc. So you can see that we're traveling on this slippery slope.
Very slippery slope. I feel.
And if it's very routine in your fertility clinic, adding on these genetic tests is not really extra work. But then we're also getting fertile people saying, "Oh, well, actually, we'll do that, and then we can make our perfect family with the boy first, then the girl, and the right height predisposition and sporting ability, et cetera, et cetera." Right. You can see where we could be headed. We're not quite there yet, but certainly it's rapidly approaching.
Right. And as fast as these technologies have advanced in the last 30, 40 years, certainly. And also, like, I can empathize or sympathize a little, I guess, with, you know, when you're in the clinic and you've been struggling with, so talk about the couples that are struggling with infertility and they're finally, you know, they're paying money, right? They're going through this emotional turmoil and struggle. So these add-ons at times, you know, it seems like, oh, yes, we want this, we want this, we want this, we want anything to guarantee that we are, or, you know, increase the rate of having a healthy baby at the end of all of this. And so I can certainly understand how it can kind of escalate, these add-ons. Do you think that these, taking a sidestep to the add-ons, do you think that couples, this is my skeptic in me, do you think that they're being properly informed and educated on these, or do you think they're being kind of sold them? Like, oh, might as well, you know?
The data at the moment is they're being sold them. We've published some studies. The Australian group that govern fertility treatment in Victoria, in Australia, called VARTA, they've also published a number of similar papers to us, looking at how clinics are marketing them and asking the patients how they've been sold them and how they feel about them. And we know that they've been really made very glossy and shiny, and, you know, this might help you. And the language around how they've been marketed is very misleading. And I've been that IVF patient, and I tried reflexology, I tried acupuncture, you know, I'd started looking at nutritional supplements, you know, I tried all those things, because you've had a few failed cycles, you will try anything. I always say, if your doctor says stand on your head every day and drink a pint of milk, you know, you would do it. You really can become obsessive by this and think, oh, if I just do this, you know, just do that. You know, if I had a transfer around the full moon, I thought that was a good omen. You know, it's really hard. You're a really vulnerable person when you're going through this treatment. You feel, well, I felt like my body had failed me, and I couldn't even carry a pregnancy and give birth when almost every other woman could. And that feeling of being barren and a failure was very, very deep for many, many years, and that this might not ever work. And for some people, it doesn't. So you are desperate and you're vulnerable. And some people will get bankrupt from all the money that they've paid out for this. So in the UK, a very slim amount of our fertility treatment is funded by the health service. The majority is not, but add-ons are not funded, luckily. So even an NHS patient, these prices can go up. And in other countries, it can really double, triple the price of one cycle. I know people in the UK that used all of their savings on one cycle, which should have been two or three, but because they got sold all the add-ons, all their money went in one go. And that's so sad, really, really sad. And I don't think, we've done some studies with the doctors to ask them how they felt about add-ons. So we've also just submitted this paper. And they do feel that patients come with a list and they have to spend some of their time convincing them. But they come to the list because the clinics have put this very positive information out there about the add-ons. But also in the UK, fertility is becoming a lot more corporate. So there are now big chains of clinics, you know, 10 clinics have all been bought up by, you know, venture capitalists, et cetera. And their aim is to make money.
Yeah.
So the doctors, in some way, their hands are tied now. They're having to do what their, you know, what the owners of the company are telling them to do, which is make money.
Right.
And I have a saying that I really feel we should be making families and not making money.
I like that. It seems like a huge conflict of interest. We have the same problem in the United States as well. Yeah. It's a marketing issue now, not so much a tender care for a woman and a family. And I don't think that the physicians mean it to be that way, like you said. You know, I think that they do care about their patients. So I don't want to vilify physicians here, but it is becoming, their hands are becoming tied. Yeah. So I'm so excited for all your papers that are coming down the pipeline. And again, I want to say that I'll include a link to your website at the end so that people can find those. And speaking of studies, I get like little news alerts when things are happening. And I just saw that for their study, the PES, researchers at the Feinstein Institute have just been awarded like $2.9 million from the NIH to study this. What do you think about that research and that funding?
I haven't read about that particular project. It's the future. Everyone loves tech. You know, going back to femtech, everyone loves it. Everyone loves a gadget on their phone. Everyone loves to do new technology and cutting edge. And I don't want to stop the development of technology. There's many things that are really fabulous out there, but I also don't want us to exploit people. And I want us to do the best that we can. So for me, going back to grassroots education, starting in schools, I think is so important. And we're very lucky in the UK. 5 years ago, we set up the UK Fertility Education Initiative. And we now have the UK curriculum by our Department for Education has included that we have to teach fertility in schools. We never had that on the curriculum before. They said you've got to teach children how not to get pregnant, how not to get an sexually transmitted infection, but never how to have a healthy pregnancy. So preconception health, when's the important time in your menstrual cycle if you're trying to get pregnant, are really important issues. And also the menopause. So we also now will be teaching the menopause in UK schools, which is so important.
It's so important. Preventing pregnancy and having a baby, they're so tightly married. So if you if you're talking about one, like, let's talk about the other. I love that. I think that's so important that we bring that into the schools. And I think we need to acknowledge that we need to have these hard conversations as a society. Like, it's opportunity cost, right? We learn that in economics in college. Like, if you put off having children, then you have to understand that it might become difficult later. Or, we can't have our cake and eat it too. You mentioned kind of exploitation and in that regard. So I want to really quick before we end, talk about a topic then. I recently read a book that it's called Everything Below the Waist, Why Healthcare Needs a Feminist Revolution. And in it, the author says the women who have access to these reproductive technologies and the women who are supplying them, so eggs or wombs in the case of egg donation or surrogacy, are divided along racial and class lines. And this is something we've kind of chatted about today, but she goes on to state that Black women are more likely to experience infertility, but less likely to get any type of treatment or care. So it does seem like these technologies are largely offered or available to the upper class and to the wealthy. And those who might be providing the services, again, in like donation or surrogacy, are more lower class. And this selecting of genes and these add-ons also seem to appeal to upper class. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe the social issues that we could face because of this?
We do have a saying in the UK that fertility treatment is a white middle-class treatment. Mm. We've had a number of events. The first event was run by Jessica Hepburn, who runs something called Fertility Fest. And she ran an event called Race and Reproduction. And I was lucky enough to be at this event. And it was just amazing to hear men and women of different races tell us the problems that they were going through, accessing, being treated, etc. And then this year. We get with COVID, we muddled up all the
years.
This year we did an International Women's Day event on race and reproduction as well. It's on YouTube. It's on my YouTube channel. It's really important. I even have a PhD student looking at race and reproduction in men and how different cultures are thinking about reproduction and the issues around reproduction and healthcare in general. And I absolutely feel that it's going to be so elitist. So the whole pre-implantation genetic testing, the sex selection, how all of these things that people are going to do, they have got to have a huge income to do this. And we also know, for example, same-sex couples that are going for the fertility treatment. For example, same-sex female couples, it's quite common now for one to produce the eggs and the other one to carry the baby so that they're both very much involved. Mm-hmm. So one's the birth mother, but one's the genetic mother. But that's hugely expensive. So in the old days, same-sex female couples just, you know, got a turkey baster and some donor sperm and did it in their kitchen. You know, now they've added on this fertility clinic, which is very, you know, I can see the absolute point of doing the shared system there with sharing eggs and womb. But they've added on, you know, £10,000 or dollars to do this. And then obviously with same-sex male couples as well, egg donation and surrogacy is hugely expensive. So for all of us across all of our different race, reproduction, everything, we're becoming elitist. There are countries around the world where they have wonderful funding systems. So for example, in Belgium, it's 6 cycles of fertility treatment are fully funded. And there's other countries that have a similar system. But in the UK and the US, where most of it's private, we have many people who will never be able to have a child because they can't even afford to try one cycle. Mm-hmm. And then, as I said, the more complicated treatment is absolutely only open to a very small number of the population. So it's become so expensive. It's a multi-billion dollar business. I think if you go onto, there's loads of different, there's MIT and Forbes, mm-hmm. and everyone put out the value of IVF globally, and it comes to billions. So just in the UK, it's about 320 million a year, every year. There's clinics that are sold for, you know, 80, 90 million pounds in the UK. There was one very recently. It's big business. And who's paid for that? It's the patients that have paid for that. Yeah. So I do think, going back to that saying, we're making, not me personally, but right. people are making money and not making families.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people that started fertility treatment, the first success, you know, Bob Edwards and Patrick Steptoe, yeah, Bob Edwards was a big socialist. He believed that this should be open to everybody. And if he was alive today, he would be horrified at the way that this has developed. You know, his technology has now become big, big business.
A way to profit instead of a way to help. Yeah. Wow. Well, unfortunately, our time is over. It has been such a privilege to have you on the show. Thank you so, so much for taking the time out of your very, very busy day to chat and share your work with us. I look forward to reading more about your work. You have so much on your website. Listeners and viewers can go to Joyce's website and purchase a signed copy of her latest book, as well as find much more information. That website is joyceharper.com. joyceharper.com. You can also find and follow Joyce on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Her handle is @ProfJoyceHarper, P-R-O-F Joyce Harper. I'd like to thank every listener for subscribing and tuning in. But Joyce, thank you so, so much. I really appreciate it. You have been a wealth of knowledge, and your expertise is a breath of fresh air. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been really great fun.
Yes. Our goal, as ever here on Venus Rising, is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you all to think beyond the masses. Thank you all for listening.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.